apologize.
My name is Rick. I'm an alcoholic. You know, everybody left me. I came through this area when I was 18 years old on a freight train. I was riding the rails from Sacramento up to Tacoma, and then we went hitchhiking after that. We were hitchhiking before that, and I was on the lam. I was running from the police, avoiding prosecution. And I had to go back and deal with that eventually, but that's typical of my life. That's the sort of thing that was going on a lot in my life at a very young age. I was in trouble a lot as a kid. And I want to talk to you a little bit about some things that happened to me early on. Some of it was, I used to think was quite important, but as I've stayed sober, it's very different for me today. I grew up in a family with alcoholism. Both my parents were alcoholics. My dad was drunk all the time when I was a kid, and my mother was drinking real heavy too, but she was better dealing with it than he was. And he worked for the post office sorting mail between Chicago and Minneapolis on the train, so he'd be gone for a week and then home for a week. And when he was gone, obviously I had no experience with him. When he was home, he was drunk and I didn't want to be around him. So I really didn't know my dad very well. I knew my mother not a heck of a lot better. She was working nights. My sister Ann was raising me primarily. And from the time I was about 8, 9 years old on, she was really the primary person in my life. So I'm hanging around with people 6 years older, and I had a lot of fun when I was a kid. I really did not have a negative childhood, even though there were things that were negative that happened. I was in trouble a lot because skipping classes, skipping school, stealing, things like that. They were talking to me about why I was acting the way I was acting, and I heard it loud and clear that I was a product of my circumstances, see? Then my dad got sober when I was 11. He moved out. Didn't mean much to me. It meant a lot to people who were talking to me over the years, because I was in trouble in school, in trouble with the law. They'd look at these circumstances in my life, and because of alcoholism, and then now my dad moves out and they're divorced. There were things like that that they were talking to me about. Within a year, she sold the house to my dad. He moved in, she moved out. I lived with my sister and my dad from that point, and that's the way I was raised. That's just the way it was. I had a lot of fun as a kid. I didn't even realize I had a bad childhood until I started listening to people, okay? And people will give you a problem if you listen to them. Trust me, they really will. Well-meaning people in AA will do this. You know, a new guy will get excited about the program. We'll say, oh, he's on that treatment center. You got to come down and be miserable like the rest of us, you know. So, it's sad. We sabotage people with that stuff. I don't do that to new guys. I'm telling you, they've been telling me for 24 years now that I got to come off my treatment center high. I'm not coming down. So if you're new, don't listen to that. You can be happy in your neurosis. Okay. If you had to have everything fixed up, none of us would be happy. So don't worry. It really isn't an issue here. It doesn't have to be. But a lot of times we just talk people right out of their joy. You know, it's, wow. you know, I'm going to, I think I'll, Cece it is, isn't it? She's sitting in front. She used to live in California. She told me, and I'm gonna do this talk sort of like you do in Hollywood. Here's how they do it in Hollywood. They tell their story this way. It's what it was like, what happened, and what we were wearing. So this one's for you. where the heck was I? Anyway. You know, I was in trouble constantly as a kid. It's just the way it was. And like I said, my mother, when she moved out, they switched. places. She literally moved into my dad's apartment. They switched places. And I lived with my dad and my sister from that point. And my mother got involved in another alcoholic marriage, typical. And I don't think she ever really looked at her alcoholism, to my knowledge anyway. And my sister and I used to go over there on the weekends. She was dragging me around to parties with her, and everybody was drinking. You know, alcohol was just part of growing up with me. I didn't think anything of it. It never occurred to me there was any problem with any of that stuff, even though my family, it was full of problems with this. But my mother was drinking real heavy, and she was really depressed. And we'd go over once in a while, and she'd be passed out in a chair at 7, 8 o'clock at night, you know, listening to blues music, listening to Ray Charles, Nat King Cole. Boy, I'm telling you, listen to Ray Charles's older stuff. It's unbelievably emotional and depressing if you got a problem around relationships. And I think most people seem to have that trouble. She was listening to that stuff, and she was just extremely depressed. My brother Bill, who's second oldest, I got a brother 10 years older, one 9 years older than I am, and then another brother 3 years older. My sister's 6 years older. So I didn't know my older siblings, but my brother very well anyway, but my brother Bill had asked my dad, and I got this in a letter from my dad years later, talking to me about what happened. And my brother had asked my dad to get somebody to help my mother, because my dad was sober now about 5-6 years. And, you know, for some reason, he didn't follow through with that, probably resentment. Who knows what went on with that deal. But everybody knew she was in trouble. So I'm over there for my 15th birthday. And when I got there, she was drinking. She was already drinking when I got there, and that's at noon. By the time we ate at 3 p.m, she was just hammered, and I got in her face about her drinking, something I'd never done before. I called her a drunk to her face, and it was just a negative afternoon when I did that. And we ate dinner, and it was just a sullen atmosphere from that point on, and called a cab because I just wanted to get away from there. I didn't like this scene. I'd been around her drinking a lot, and I didn't like it. So it took the cab a couple hours to get there because it snowed real heavy that day, and we had to sit in that. And when that cab showed up, I was absolutely thrilled to get away from there. And my brother Dan told me years later, and I'd forgotten about this, that she had asked me to take my birthday cake, and I wouldn't do it. I'm gonna punish her. Show her how displeased I was with her, you know. Angry young man, 15 years old. Cab came, we got in it. I see her waving as we drove away. I was just disgusted with her. Well, that night she killed herself, committed suicide, shot herself with her husband's handgun. And, you know, these were things that people were talking to me about. It was common. I tell you, these were, and it was, I'm sure it made a lot of sense that that's why I was acting the way I was acting, that sort of thing. But I want to tell you a couple quick stories. One is really the only memory that I have of my family, if you will, sitting in the kitchen. Because my brothers were so much older, when I came along through, the family was dissolving fairly rapidly at that point. They moved out, went to school, got married, that sort of thing. But this particular memory is all of us are sitting in the kitchen eating. And I grew up in a one-bedroom house in South Minneapolis, 750 square feet. Wasn't a very big house. We had a bad expansion in the upstairs with a stairway that went straight up and down, you know. But we used it. It was a narrow room. We used it for bedrooms. And so, you know, my cousins had come up from Chicago with four kids and two adults. We'd all sleep in this place. There'd be bodies everywhere. These are fine memories. These are great memories that I have. I had a lot of fun back then. Those were times when we were all together and it was exciting. It was just, because I was so much younger than everybody else, it was just an exciting time. But, you know, we used it for bedrooms up there and that sort of thing. And my dad had built a bedroom down in our basement. And, you know, when he was building it, I was thinking, I wonder who's going to get that. And I figured, well, it's going to be my sister. I'm certainly not going to get it being the youngest. I was amazed when my dad ended up down there. My mother wouldn't sleep with him anymore because he was such a sloppy drunk and he'd make a mess in the bathroom and that sort of thing. So here we're sitting at the kitchen, we're eating. I happen to be facing the back of the house, and she's at a stove cooking. See, the basement door is off to the right, and my dad's down in the basement drunk. Okay, he's in the room he built. Okay, and she's taking clothesline and tied it around the doorknob. You know, the door swings into the room. Taking clothesline, tied it around a doorknob, and swung it around the corner to a hook, and then back and forth, wove it like that, see? So the door couldn't open. And I hear him, Dan and I, he's the one closest in age to me, we happen to be facing that back of the house, and he's rattling on the door, trying to get up. He wants to come out of the cave, you know, and he's hammered. He's just loaded. And my mother's screaming at him, get back down there, you, and I won't say what she said, but it wasn't good. And she's angry, and it's just a kind of a weird situation. And about 10 minutes go by, it calms down, you know, it quiets down. And about 10 minutes go by, and I look over, and I'm just going to take a bite, and I look, and I see, all you can see is the end of a saw blade sticking through the crack in the door. And he's sawing the ropes, you know. He's like, and it's a strange sight, you know, on this side of the door, you know. And I nudge him down, look at it, and we laughing, you know, we shouldn't be laughing, but we're laughing. And he gets it cut, and he swings the door open, kind of like high, you know, that sort of thing. And he's standing there with one of these sleeveless shirts on. He's about 5'10", 5'11". He's real thin because he's been drinking for a lot of years. And he's got boxer shorts on, and he's got these black horn-rimmed glasses on upside down. And I looked at this. This is like a Laurel and Hardy deal, you know. I just said, whoa, it was too much. And I just busted up. Dan was laughing. And I got to tell you, it wasn't funny to my mother. Oh, she looked at him, and, I mean, she's angry because she had him tied up down there, She grabs one of those big cast iron frying pans, and she goes after him with this. She's going to slug him with this thing. And my brother Bob got up. He's the one his oldest. And he grabbed her and stopped her, and my dad just kind of waddled down the hallway to the bathroom, made a mess, of course, as usual, and then came back and went back down into the cave. And that was the end of the dinner show for the evening. You know, it was just, this is the way it was. It was just the way it was. So these are things that were, just went on. I don't know. I didn't think too much of it. I got to tell you, you know, I was, my dad died, you know, he sobered up, and he stayed sober, but he died about 3 years ago. And I was at my brother Bob's house, and these things were funny to me, but I gotta tell you, I was telling him that story and reminding him of that event, because I thought that was funny right from the start. He didn't think it was funny. I gotta tell you, he had a different experience in the family, and it was tragic to him. And my second oldest brother, Bill, who had asked my dad to get somebody to help my mother, he died drunk, and I talked to him a week before he died, angry at his circumstances and at my dad, and he was just, he told me, and this is sad, he told me he used to lay under his bed when he was a little kid, when my parents were arguing in the other room, and he'd sit there and, or lay there and count the bed springs to try not to hear what was going on in the other room. Wow. I didn't have that experience. I just didn't. That wasn't going on when I came through. I didn't see it, you know. So I was very happy as a kid. I really was. But this stuff wasn't funny to my older brothers. My sister, I don't know what she did with that stuff. I think she maybe missed some of that too. But I was happy. I really was. My brother used to make fun of me, Dan, for being, when I was a kid, he called it overjoyed. I was 10 years old, 9 years old, living in a family of alcoholism, and I was overjoyed. Isn't that amazing? Well, I missed it somehow. I don't know. I just missed the problem. I think that's maybe been a lot of things in my life. Some of it not so good, but in this case, it was good. So that's sort of the way I was raised, or the way things were as I grew up. But, you know, this thing about blaming your circumstances and the events and these, you know, it's easy to hang your hat on that stuff. And I'll tell you, I could get a lot of people on my side with that when I was drinking. You know, you could get a tear in a guy's eye next to you at the bar telling them all about how bad your childhood was, see. But I didn't experience it that way. I was happy when I was young. It was when I started listening to people later on that I started to lose my joy. And that's really what happened. And I become more and more angry as I got older. You know, I'll tell you something, why I don't buy that today. And I'll just give you a quick story. When I was 5 years old, they had given me a little cap gun. You know, you pull the trigger, little roll of caps, little dots of gunpowder, see? And I was 5 years old. I got a picture of me with that little gun, you know, in a holster and a star on my, in a vest or something, and, you know, cowboy hat and that sort of thing. I hated the gun was terrible. It just was boring. You pull the trigger, you get a little pop. I found out, though, that if you took the caps out of the gun and leave it rolled up and hit it with a hammer, the whole roll goes off at once. And I got to tell you, if you haven't tried this, this is impressive. I whacked a roll 4 months ago, something like that. So somebody gave me some caps this last summer, and it's amazing. It really is. So now I'm going through a lot of caps, and my mother won't buy me any more caps, and I'm standing at a hardware store, and Dan's with me, and my mother's shopping. And all the toys are there, and we're looking at it, and he's 8 years old. And I see the caps on the shelf, and I grabbed a handful. I made a conscious decision at 5 years old to steal them. So I took a handful, and I stuck them in my pocket. And I grabbed another handful, and I was just going to put them in my pocket, and Dan's next to me. He goes, "Rick, that guy over there saw you." So I shoved him in his pocket, and he got caught, okay? We both got in trouble. It was a nightmare. Dan told me years later, he says, "You know, I've been nervous around you ever since that event." You know, I just, well, who wouldn't be? Here, I'm giving him the problem. I'm putting it on somebody else, see? This is the way my mind was when I was young. It's just the way my head was. I was like this from the time I was 5. That didn't stop me. You know, I told that story years ago, and a guy come up to me, I'm talking 20-some years ago, and a guy come up to me after the talk, and he says, "You know, I had a similar experience where I got caught stealing when I was 5. And he says, "I never stole again." Isn't that something? Not me. Not me. You know what I did? I never missed a beat. I continued to steal, and I continued to try and give the problem to somebody else. And that's a common theme in my life. And it started when I was 5. I was like this. It isn't because of alcoholism, my family. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. It wasn't because of divorce or suicide. These things hadn't happened yet. It was because I made these choices and decisions, and I wanted what I wanted. And I'm an enthusiastic guy. You know, I don't like the small pop. I got to have the big explosion. 5, I'm like this. Isn't that something? And I think you guys are probably like that too, or you wouldn't be in this room, okay? You don't get here without being enthusiastic, you know? You know what I'm talking about. The only thing drunks don't do with enthusiasm is the steps. You know what I mean? It's true. Oh, I need balance now. You know, I've heard that. Honest to God, I wish I had a buck for every time I heard that one, you know? I need balance now. Why don't you do this enthusiastically? Oh, no. Easy does it. Easy does it. And they use the slogans to kill themselves. Man, half measures avail me nothing. I got to tell you, I want to tell you something that just happened to me in the last few days. At least I found out about it in the last few days. I got a friend named Ray who I've known, my God, for 20-some years. Ray was a little older than I was. He was in his 60s, and nice man. I got to tell you, he was sober for 36 years, and he started drinking. Wow. This is about 2 years ago when he started drinking. And I got to tell you something. I've seen guys do this with long-term sobriety and not get back. And I don't know what it is, but they just can't seem to get it back. And Ray was like that. And I hung around with Ray. I mean, I knew him real well. I traveled with him. I did say he was a nice man. Everybody loved Ray but Ray. He was one of these guys. He helped people all the time. I'm not kidding you. Ray had this negative opinion of himself, like he had nothing to give and he couldn't help anybody. And he was in that mode. He had some mental illness, but he was a sweet guy. Over a period of years, he's constantly calling newcomers, trying to stay out of his own crap, doing whatever he can do, and he's active, and he's doing what he can do because he's got this mental illness problem, see? Well, and I'm telling you, he's got a mean mind in terms of himself. It's really sad. Well, he's been fighting this for all his life, all of his adult life. And one day, about 10 years ago, we were sitting in a meeting, about 30 of us, And this guy comes into the meeting. Now, Ray's in this mode of hating himself, and he's doing this stuff, see? And I'm trying to, you know, I've been a cheerleader for Ray all along, man. That's what I do with him. I just cheerlead him all the time, you know? And because he's giving all the time, and he's really helping people. This guy comes in. He's in this mode, ready to go into the nut ward again, okay? He's just insane. And some guy comes into our meeting, and he sits down. We go around the room, and this guy all of a sudden perks up. Never been to the meeting, never came back again. He looks over, and he says, "And that guy over there saved my life 10 years ago." He's pointing to Ray. I tell you, this happened at least 7-8 times that I know of where people have said this about him over the years. Yet he couldn't help himself. He just couldn't. I don't know what it is. You know, there was a time when I thought he was one of those who would not do it. You know, it says in chapter 5, there are those who will not or cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program. I always felt he was a will not guy. He just wouldn't do certain things. And he was rebellious and stubborn. But I got to tell you, he shifted over to a point about a couple months, 3 months ago. I really had this feeling that he could not do it. He just couldn't do it. And on the 29th, last time I saw him, I was having breakfast with somebody else, and he showed up, and he was just wigged out. He'd been in and out of the nut wards and stuff, and he I don't know if he was having problems with medications or something, but he was just wigged out, and his neck was twitching, and it was just weird to look at him. And I said, "You got to go to the doctor and find out what's going on." And that was the last time I saw him. He went into his garage, and he ran the car and killed himself. See? Just happened. We just found out about it. It happened back then. But I just found out a couple days ago that this happened. So here's a guy, lovely man, who just simply seems to me could not do it. And it's sad because we see this stuff once in a while around the fellowship. And I tried to help her. I couldn't help him. I knew he had to make certain decisions, you know. And he did. He finally made a decision. And it was a tragic one, but he made a decision. So this kind of stuff goes on all the time around AA. When you've been around a while, you see this sort of thing. And it's tragic. You know, it kind of reminds me of a joke or a story of a guy standing at the casket at the funeral with his dad. And his dad says to him, it's his son's friend. He says, "My God, what happened to him? He looks so young." And the son says, "Well, he drank himself to death." And the old man says, "Well, my God, hadn't he ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous?" And the son says, "Well, he wasn't that bad." You know, that's it. You know, "Well, you're not that bad." I got to tell you, you know, it's there's a lot of truth in that one, I'll tell you. But this is quite an affair we got here with this. But, you know, I'm one of the fortunate ones because I got miserable enough. And I'll give you a quick story of my drink. And I could tell you all kinds of things. I could tie you up for 45 minutes with a drunkologue that would be, a lot of it's really quite funny. But it doesn't have much value. I don't like to tell stories that don't have a point to it, okay? I really don't. So, but I'll tell you how I drank enthusiastically. We'd get a keg of beer, four guys. 8-gallon keg, four guys. That's the right amount, isn't it? No? Yeah. If you had five guys, you bought a 16-gallon keg. You never put five guys on an 8. So we're drinking for effect. There's no question about that, okay? We'd take the keg, put it in somebody's living room, take it down to the river, because I live in Minneapolis. The Mississippi River runs through there between the cities. Minneapolis and St. Paul, we'd go down there and we'd drink together, me and my buddies. We didn't have many women with us. Very rarely were women around us because we were drunks at a very early age, and women didn't want to come around us. And these guys are nuts. They're fighting all the time and stuff. Well, we'd be standing around the keg drinking, and we'd put each other down as we drank with each other. That was the game. And the guy who could do it the best won some kind of a prize for insanity or negativity or something. And I was good at this game, and I was sarcastic and negative, and my humor was directed at people. And halfway through those kegs, that's when you'd be fist fighting with each other. These were opportunities to tell your buddies exactly what you thought of them. Oh, you'd say, well, I'm just kidding. Well, I don't know about them, but I wasn't. I'm telling you, that's when the truth started to come out. And that's what we do. So we drink like this. We'd be fighting with each other, and it was just insanity, and that's the way it was. It was always that way with us. I hung around with a lot of guys, just a drunk. And my humor was sarcastic and cutting and negative. And I got to tell you, I had to deal with that stuff when I got sober. And that's the stuff. You know, I'm more concerned about sharing with you what my mind was like, because these are the things I've got to deal with. When I got sober, I had to deal with this stuff. So I got to a bottom. And I want to tell you, my bottom was absolutely horrific. I never want to experience that again. It was an absolute nightmare. I was very physically addicted to alcohol. I was in withdrawal with booze all the time. I couldn't sleep at night. I'd have to be half in the bag to go to sleep. It'd be 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock. I'd get to sleep, and then I'd have to get up and go to work, and I'd miss work, and I'd lose jobs, and that's the way it was. And that was constant in my life. So I'm in that mode, and I came to a place one day. I don't even really want to tell you the story, but I'll tell you. I was burglarizing the Social Security office. Okay, we used to make up fake. We used to make up fake identities. I had birth certificates. I had an impression stamp, and we'd sell identities. Okay, I was hanging around a lot of guys who needed new identities, you know, and I was trying to go to an outpatient treatment program to get my kids and family, get Pam and the kids to come back. Pam and I were together for 11 years. We had two boys. They were 4 and 6 years old when I got sober. And I was trying to get my family back. I didn't want to lose my family. I didn't want to do to my family what my dad did to his. I hated him for it. What do you think all that judgment's going to come if she doesn't come back? So I wanted to get her back in the worst way, I got to tell you, because I knew all that hatred was coming on me. I knew that before I got sober. And I'm in that mode. So I'm going to this outpatient program. I go across the street to the Social Security office, and I hide up in the ceiling of the bathroom until they close. And then I come down, and I was doing business with Social Security office anyway. I was buying some desks and things from them. I had a store called Chicago Supply Company. It was an antique plumbing fixture store. And we used to buy and sell anything we could get our hands on. And it didn't matter what it was, you know. It just didn't matter. Anything you could, it was antique plumbing fixtures, but it was a lot of other things going on in there. So I'm hanging around with heroin addicts, cocaine addicts, speed freaks are dealing stuff through this place. And it's a nightmare. I mean, it's just, when it's in your place, it gets real crazy. So we're in the mode of trying to keep money coming in, and I'm trying to get my family back by going to this program, and I'm not stopped. I'm crazy. I go across the street, and I'm hiding in the ceiling now until they close, and I come down that night, and I was going to buy desks and stuff from them, so I had some sense of what was going on in there, but I really wanted to go in and plant records in their files so I could get Social Security cards to go with the birth certificates. I don't know how I was going to do this. I guess I thought I'd sit at a typewriter or something and do that. I don't know. You know, it's just, you get so twisted after a while, you do insane things, see? So I'm like that. And of course, after about 5-6 hours of being in there, tearing the office up, I didn't accomplish anything that I went in there to do. I was doing a lot of speed at the time, too. And you lose track of time, and, you know, it's you can read the phone book for 8 hours and think you accomplished something. You know, it's just stupid stuff, you know. And I opened the computer room, and the alarm goes off, and the police come, and I went and hid in the ceiling for 2.5 days from the cops, okay? Had some time to think. Wasn't going very well, okay? Outpatient wasn't working. Maybe I better go inpatient, okay? I got to tell you, I had fingerprints all over this place. I was very concerned about this, and I got out of there without going to jail, and I went into a real treatment center, inpatient, to hide out. I really did. I went in to hide out. In all seriousness, that's what I was doing. And during the period of time I was in there, I come off of all kinds of things, lots of withdrawals and things, and I was laying in that treatment center, And I was very afraid of going to prison for a long time. That's a federal charge, and you do a lot of time on that stuff. And 3 weeks sober, I'm laying in bed, and I came to a place in my mind where I said, I'll do anything not to live this way anymore. Anything. And I didn't say, I'll do anything except that. Okay, I said, I'll do anything. I can't stand my life. My life has been a continuous headache. I go from one courtroom to another courtroom, one jail cell to another, hawking my stolen stuff to pay attorneys I don't like. I was always trying to tell them how to do my cases and stuff, you know, and they didn't like that, and I'm in conflict with them all the time, and it's a nightmare. It's just a nightmare. And I'm sick of it. I've just had it, and I said, I'll do anything not to live this way anymore. When I said that, it induced an experience that was shocking to me. I'm a militant atheist. I'm not just sort of an atheist. I'm an enthusiastic atheist. You know what I mean? I mean, seriously, I'm not proud of some of the things that I did around this. Example, Jehovah's Witnesses had come to the door, you know, and I'd come on in, you know, we'll talk, you know. And I'd get them in the house and I'd start slamming them, and I was rude. These were kind, loving people coming to a door to a madman's house. And I was abusive, and I'm not proud of that. It's sad that I was that way, but that's the truth. And I've made this commitment. I'm just a militant atheist. And I said, I'll do anything, and then bang, this starts happening to me. I feel these rushes going through my body, and it was waves of electricity, just like somebody plugged me into the wall. And it was one wave after another, came through my head, down through my feet. I felt this peace come over me, like I'd never experienced before. With a sense of knowing, this is the weird thing, with a sense of knowing that everything would be okay if I just stuck to the commitment I just made, meaning I'll do anything, because that was the commitment I made. All of a sudden, I get this in my head. The experience was incredibly peaceful and loving, and then I get this, and I almost died. I just about flipped right out of the hospital bed I was laying in. I get Jesus Christ. And I just went, whoa, oh, no, not, you know, I'm a militant atheist, guys. I'm rude to people who talk this way, and I got this in my head. Now, no, I can't handle it. It shocked me. It set me back. And I said, no, and I pushed it out of my mind, and the experience ended when I did that. I've never had trouble staying sober since that experience. The compulsion to use was shut off like a switch, and it's never come back. No urges, nothing. Absolutely gone, just like that. I entered into a commitment with God, and I didn't even believe in God. How do you do that? I said, I'll do anything. That decision is still in force. I have never lost that commitment. That commitment carried me when I didn't believe. I came to believe much later. It didn't happen. That event did not change me in the sense of all of a sudden I believed in a God or something. It wasn't like that. I'm in total denial. That's not going to be my experience. But it shut off the booze. And when I came into AA, it never looked like a program of not drinking to me. How right that is when you start to look at the book. Yet I didn't realize any of that. I knew AA worked because I saw it work for my dad, but I didn't like my dad. But I knew it worked. Even though I didn't like him, I knew that he was different and that he stopped drinking, and it changed him. So I come into AA with all that crap that I've got in my head, but alcohol shut off, drugs gone, everything's just shut right off, just like that. Never came back. I want to read you something that was sent to me a while back. It has nothing to do with AA. Somebody, I don't even know who sent this to me. But I entered into this commitment, and that commitment has carried me when I didn't believe. Okay, you guys who believe know that it comes and goes. Faith is not always there. But I got to tell you, if my sobriety was dependent on my belief, I'd have been drunk a long time ago. It's been dependent on the commitment that I made, and that's the thing that has carried me. Here's what somebody sent me. It says, the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision. That's right. Raising in one's favor all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance which no man could have dreamed would have come his way. This is exactly what's happened to me. My life is almost like a fairy tale since that commitment was made. And I don't mean everything was perfect. I mean that everything has just kind of fallen into place. I've done a lot of things right by mistake. No, really. It's not like I knew what I was doing, but I was so miserable, I was afraid of Rick making the decisions. I'm telling you, every time I solved a problem, it got worse when I was using. You ever had that happen? I fixed my relationship with Pam. She took the kids and left. Fixed my finances. I lost the house we were living in. $50,000 in equity in one house back in the early 80s. Gone. That was a lot of money back then. Gone. Foreclosure. Lost my business. Had to auction that off. Everything I made decisions about got worse. It didn't get better. Talk about frustrating. Wow. Then when I get out of this treatment center, I'm gonna fix my relationship with Pam again, and it just got worse and worse and worse. Finally, I went to Al-Anon. Didn't take me long either. I was 3 months sober when I walked into Al-Anon. Yeah. And I've been going ever since. Yeah, almost 24 years now. It will be in December in Al-Anon. I go every week. In fact, Pam, my ex, is remarried, and her husband was having a lot of problems with the booze a while back. So I'm taking her now. She comes with me. I pick her up. I do. I was never rejected from that family. You know why? Because I cleaned up my mess. I did inventory and I got honest. I never cheated her on child support. I don't understand guys who do that stuff. It makes no sense to me. Okay? But it's really a guy who hasn't done inventory. Because once I saw what I did, I didn't want to hurt her. The last thing I wanted to do was hurt her more. But I had to get honest, see, and that's been the key to this whole thing, see, has been the honesty thing. So I got involved in Al-Anon, and I, you know, you might think, well, why should I go to Al-Anon? I could tell you in one sentence, you know. I go to AA to keep from committing suicide and Al-Anon to keep from committing murder. I can tell you in one sentence how this atheist came to believe. In one sentence, I took actions I didn't believe in, and I got results I couldn't deny. That's what's happened. I took actions. It made no sense. I did inventory. And I want to talk a little bit about that process and what's happened to me in that, because that's really what I would rather talk about. You know, I had to take a look at some things. You know, in the big book in chapter 5, it starts out, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, right? Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program. So who are these guys? Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. Honest with themselves. You know how I heard that? Honest with everybody else. Come to realize when you've been around a while, you got a lot of company with that idea. Lots of us hang our hat on, well, I've been sober a long time, you know, I'm honest with everybody else, I quit lying, I quit stealing, and I'm working a program. And I got to tell you, that's not my idea at all. They're talking about honest with ourselves, see, but I heard it the other way, and I became rigidly, rigorously honest with everybody else. And I was like, I was just a pain to people, you know. Now I'm around, and I'm like the guy who quits smoking and wants you to quit smoking, you know. The guy who quits drinking wants you to quit drinking. Rigid, angry, you know. Well, believe me, a lot of people got out of my way. I was just insane. Full speed ahead with this one, see. We're talking about self-deception. And as you get into the process, you start to see that's what it is. Okay, self-deception. I'll give you an example of self-deception from my own life. I got tons of them. I'll tell you one that you didn't hear. Okay. When I was about 18 years old, I was drinking with a guy in my living room. I just met him that day, okay? We got drunk. A friend introduced us. We got drunk, and I woke up the next morning, and he's gone, and my money's gone. The guy ripped me off. So I called up people. I looked, we didn't order food. We didn't go anywhere that I could recall, but I used to black out all the time, so it wasn't uncommon, okay? So I called up the people who introduced me to him, and I slammed him to everybody. Nobody seemed to know him very well. He just blew in, grabbed my money, and blew out. So, but I did. I made sure that everybody knew that he ripped me off, okay? A couple of months went by. I found my money. I hid it when I was drunk because I was afraid he might steal my money, see? So I already had the idea in my mind that he was going to take my money. And when I couldn't find my money the next day, I came across it in a drawer or something. And it was a couple months later, and I thought, oh, this is bad when you have an experience like that. And especially when you slam the guy to a bunch of people. You know, that's always great stuff, you know. So now I've come awake, and I realized that he didn't steal my money. Now, do you think I called these people up? And of course not. A couple of months have gone by. I'm embarrassed by this stuff, see. I don't do anything about it, but I'm embarrassed by it, see. So I don't clean that up. I have no integrity around this sort of thing. So I leave that perception out there for that guy to deal with. You know, and people talk, and who knows where that went. And then you hate yourself just a little bit with every one of those you got. And if you do a lot of that stuff, you just have this self-loathing inside of you. And you don't like, I didn't like reality. I want, you know, I found out how you can get over those thoughts. You know how you do it? You drink. You can drink them away. But do they ever go anywhere, really? It was still in me. That story came back to me about 12 years ago. I forgot all about it. And you know, when it came back, the guilt was still there. The remorse about what I did was still there. It didn't go anywhere. But I used to drink negative thoughts away when I do stuff like that. I had no integrity. I wouldn't deal with anything, see? It's embarrassing. Wow. Self-deception. Here I'm clearly wrong when I would have bet anything I was right. Well, if you've had an experience like that, then I'd ask this. How many things could I be wrong about right now and I haven't found out yet? How about that one? You ever thought about that? I could be living under the illusion, a lot of illusions, that people like me and they don't. Or that they don't like me and they do. I'll do a workshop tomorrow. I'll tell you a story about that one. That was another one that I got caught with. Okay? But here it is, self-deception. I got to tell you, how would you know? You might think, well, I don't have it. Well, how would you know? I mean, isn't self-deception the guy who doesn't know it, who's got it? Well, I've had a lot of this stuff, and I wasn't aware of it until I started asking the right questions. So they've got an inventory in here. But first of all, you got to know what a problem is if you're going to solve a problem, right? Page 62 of Alcoholics Anonymous book, it says, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Wow, so it's not alcohol. No. Selfishness. Yeah, that's the root of our troubles. Then it says, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Is that what's been going on? I've been stepping on the toes of my fellows and they've been retaliating? It's not always like that, is it? Well, that's what I had to inventory. I started to look at it, see? Started to get honest. So selfishness is the problem. Why? Because I end up angry. You know, the guy who's selfish ends up angry. Why? Because I'm not getting what I want. It makes me angry when I don't get what I want. Doesn't it you? Sure. That's why anger comes from selfishness. And that's why we're going to look at selfishness and in our resentments. We're going to look for the anger behind or the selfishness behind the anger. And when I started to do that, well, I'll give you some examples of some things. This has been important, but this thing about selfishness, You know, it's really easy to kind of slough that off. I looked the word up because I didn't understand really. I thought I knew what it meant. But here's what the dictionary says, Webster's Dictionary. And this is word for word. It says, concerned excessively or exclusively with oneself. Seeking or concentrating on one's own advantage, pleasure, or well-being without concern for others. That's the qualifier. The other definition said without regard for others, okay? So selfish is I'm doing for myself and I'm not considering other people, okay? I'm always looking for an advantage, aren't you? I'm looking for pleasure and well-being. And in achieving that, I don't consider other people. It's not that I'm bad. I just don't consider others. You know, when I was using and forcing the family to have to move, and the electricity's going on and off, and the water and all this stuff, and I'm having all kinds of problems, and the children are going through stuff. They're not getting certain clothes, and sometimes they don't have money for food, and it's just a pain for Pam. Never did it. I mean, I wasn't trying to hurt my family. I was wrapped up in addiction, and all I could think about is what I needed at those times. It wasn't that I was bad, I just didn't consider others. And I've had to learn, and when we teach inventory to people, what I do with it is I try and get guys to look at selfishness factually. It's not good, it's not bad, it's a fact. I'm doing for myself, I'm not considering other people. Get out of the judgment or you won't look at it. I've often wondered why we can read through the big book, it's talking about selfishness constantly, and you can miss it. How can you miss it? It's all over the book. Don't want to hear it. Think it's bad. I won't look if I think I'm going to judge myself. So when we teach it, we try and keep guys from doing that sort of thing with it. So selfishness is the problem. I'm driven by 100 forms of fear. What am I afraid of? Afraid I won't get what I want. I'm selfish. I'm afraid I'll lose what I got. I'm selfish. I'm driven by 100 forms of that fear. Self-delusion, I distort things. Self-seeking, I'm only concerned about Rick. And self-pity, I feel sorry for myself, right? When I don't get what I want, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. And then I look at their retaliation. I used to do this all the time. I'd look at them retaliating and I'd think, wow, what a jerk. Look at the way they're treating me. See? And I don't think they're retaliating. I think they're attacking me. See? So I get my buddy Bob and I tell him the story. And you know how you tell a story? In just the right way so he'll agree with you. Right? Right? You know how you do it? I'll exaggerate certain points like what she did. I'll minimize other points like what I did. I'll leave relevant information entirely out of the story because if I tell that to him, he won't agree with me. So I'll tailor the story till I get it just right. We join in the anger and then we hate her together. Have you seen that yet? It's exactly what I was doing. I was doing this constantly. And you know what I saw as I started to look at this? I was living in a fantasy world. It wasn't reality at all. I'd been distorting things, and I believed my own stories. That's why all resentment is justified. I'm not going to stand here and tell you your anger is not justified. Of course it is, especially the way you tell the story. Will I examine the story? That's the question, see? So I'll tell you, I just want to, before I go on with this, I just want to give you a really bad result I got from selfishness, and I didn't see it until later. All my life I've been taking. I've been a taker. Selfishness takes. Love gives. I'm out of harmony with God if I'm taking, okay? How would you get your will and life in harmony with God or love if you don't believe in God? Give. What if you made a decision to give? That's basically what that decision that I made, I'll do anything, was. Then the opportunities to be helpful around started showing up and opportunities to do 12-step work, and I never stopped. And I continued to do that on a regular basis. That's the whole, my journey started real early, man. I wanted to give. It was fun for me. I got a lot of relief out of this stuff early on, and I just wanted to share it with other people. So I'm in that mode of doing that, even as an atheist. I don't think it matters what you believe in. It's the commitment that I made not what I believed at the time. What I believed changed as time went on. So one of the things here, so I'm in this mode of taking from life. One day I saw it, and I don't know why I missed this for so long. The Christians said it this way: what you sow, you reap. On the streets, it was what goes around comes around. And I thought, that's a nice sentiment. We used to sit and talk about this stuff and drink ourselves to death and, you know, sit there and philosophize and all that crap with each other, you know, when we were drinking with each other. And that would stuff would come up. And I thought, well, it's nice sentiment, but it really isn't true, is it? You don't really receive what you give, do you? Well, I'll tell you what I saw after a while. I took and took and took until I had nothing left. Now, isn't that strange? You'd think you'd have something, wouldn't you? When I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had nothing left. My family was gone. My money was gone. My friends were gone. My house was gone. My business was gone. Everything was stripped from me. Was I receiving what I was giving? Yeah. I was taking from life, and I was losing. But I didn't think it was me. See, I had theories that said you gain by taking. No, you don't. You lose. You know, I saw a video years ago of a guy who invented the helicopter, or a form of it. His name was Arthur Young. Old man when I saw this aired. He was in his 80s probably when this, it was on a program called Thinking Aloud. In other words, it's okay to think. And that's a strange idea around AA, isn't it? Sometimes you hear, well, your best thinking got, you know, my best thinking didn't get me here. Not everything I thought before I got to AA was wrong. Now, it was close at the end. Okay, but not everything I thought. And I won't demean some guy when he comes in and tell him that crap. I just won't do that. That is not the way I'm going to talk to newcomers, man. I respect them, and I don't want to put them down that way, see? Plus, it's just not true. There's a lot of things that I've heard over the years where we do that sort of thing to new people. It bothers me a lot. Because I've got a responsibility, I think. So anyway, I've been in this mode of constant taking, see. And I'm watching this video of this guy, and he invented this helicopter, and he said they had theories of how the helicopter should fly. Then their theories are based in logic, it makes sense, and then they would build a model and fly the model to see if it worked. He said often when they did this, the model didn't obey their theories. In other words, it didn't work the way they thought it would. But they didn't say that the experience was wrong and their theories were right. No matter how logical the theory was, the experience is what's true, not the theory. Any reasonable mind would do that. Not me. You know what I was doing all my life? Trying to get the world to adapt to my theories. I come into AA, I think, well, I just got to work it harder, so I pour more energy into things that aren't working, and guess what? My life got worse. It didn't get better. Never did it occur to me to stop doing what I was doing. Why? It made sense. It was logical. It should work. Oh, this will kill you. This will just destroy you in the program if a guy can't open up to something besides his logical mind, see? Well, it was tough. I got beat pretty good on that stuff. But, you know, if you do it with enthusiasm, you'll get to a bottom. See? That's exactly what I did. So, you know, there's another idea, too, the self-esteem thing. You know, AA isn't about making a better self. It's about letting go of the self. It's been about releasing the self. Self is the problem. This has always been my problem. You know how I came to believe? In the sense of taking actions and things? Literally, what happened to me is when I started to do inventory, I started to let go of what I wasn't, all that negative stuff. What started to emerge was my spiritual nature. I didn't have to do something to be spiritual. If you get the crap out of the way, your spirituality emerges. This is very strange when you're an atheist and people start coming up to you. And I had a guy come up to me one time. I was about a year sober. It was just starting to shake loose. And this guy comes up and he says to me, because I was excited and happy. I'd done inventory and I thought the resentments were, the majority of the stuff was gone and I was excited. And this guy comes up and he says, "Will you help me spiritually?" I almost laughed in his face. I thought, "Are you kidding me? I'm still an atheist. I don't even believe." I'm thinking, well, this is the weirdest journey I've ever been on. I got to tell you, you know. Things like that were happening to me, and I'm thinking, wow, is this bizarre or what? I didn't tell him, but I didn't believe. I thought, this is so strange when these things start happening. He saw something in me that I didn't see. And that's exactly what they say in the spiritual experience in the back of the book. Other people see it long before the newcomer sees it. And that's exactly what happened to me. And as time went on, my spiritual nature started to emerge. I didn't even think about it. It never occurred to me that was happening. So if you let go of what you're not, what emerges is what you are. You don't have to do something. You got to undo something. You know, it's just a weird. Everything's backwards, you know, from the way I thought when I came in here. So anyway, you know, it's been... You know, the sincerity thing, there's a thing about sincerity too, a quote I heard from a guy years ago. He said, sincerity is not enough, what we need is honesty. And student says to him, well, what's the difference? He says, sincerity is a never-ending openness to the, or honesty is a never-ending openness to the facts. Sincerity is believing one's own propaganda. I've been doing that all my life. I bought a ticket to my own show. So anyway, you know, I come into AA, I start writing the inventory stuff out, and I want to tell you a story of something that happened. I'll just kind of briefly do this. It happened with my resentment toward my dad, and I hated this guy. All my life I'd been blaming him. I'd been blaming circumstances, the events from my childhood. And I was just rageful at this guy. And when I come into AA, I had to do something with this stuff. So I sat down and I started to write inventory, and I got stonewalled on it. You know, it said, they ask you to write in three columns. They show you three columns on page 65, okay? And the first column, I'm resentful at my dad. What's the cause? Well, he wasn't there when I was a kid. How did that affect me? Well, it affected my self-esteem because I didn't know how to deal with life. I was a failure in life. So how I saw myself, how others saw me, self-esteem. Okay. Did it affect my ambitions? Yeah, my goals for life. I didn't accomplish much. I was a failure. Did it affect my finances? Yeah, it's just everything. Sex, relationships, everything was affected because my dad would have taught me how to do these things, see? Well, as I went along, I started writing this out, and then there's a paragraph at the bottom of page 66 that says, this was our course. It says, we realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Okay? Perhaps he's spiritually sick. Boy, I felt offended when I read that. Spiritually sick, I wanted to kill him. You know, I really felt quite offended when I read that, and I almost quit because I thought, here we're going to justify crappy behavior from somebody else. We're just going to pretend like we're not angry, you know? And I just about quit writing at that point. I just about stopped the process. Thank God I didn't. Something forced me on. Again, I did the right thing by mistake, okay? It says, though we did not like their symptoms, I don't like the symptoms of their spiritual sickness and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. Wow. See, that's self-forgiveness. That's what he's talking about. Do I want compassion and understanding for my stupidities? You know, the things I've done out of my addictions? I wanted Pam to come back and give me a break. I didn't want to lose my family. Do I want others to give me a break when I've stolen from them or cheated in relationships and I've broken up my family or relationships that were important to me? I did this stuff all my life. Do I want people to give me a break? Yeah. Well, guess what? I got to give that to other people then. Why? Because you're judging yourself as harshly as you judge others. And if other people can't make mistakes, what am I saying to myself? So it literally is a process of self-forgiveness. And I can't do it on my own because I keep justifying my anger through my stories. I got all these stories that I justify. why my anger is okay, why it's reasonable. You got to make it reasonable or you couldn't do it. See? It says we ask God to help us. This is the beauty of AA. We ask God to help us. Show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. I can't do it on my own because I keep justifying my anger. I missed this when I first wrote this inventory. I missed what I just read to you. I went right into the fourth column. It says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Here's another thing that gets distorted around our fellowship. People say we're looking for our part. No, we're not. We're looking for our mistakes. We're putting out of our mind the wrongs others had done. If I was looking for my part, I haven't put out of my mind the wrongs others had done. You see what I mean? Then they give you the questions where the mistakes are. Where was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Then Bill says, though a situation had not been entirely our fault, okay, we'll give you that much. We tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. See what it, where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man. So I couldn't do it with my dad because I had everybody telling me I was right, and I set it aside, and I went to the next resentment. It happened to be with Pam, my ex. And I was angry at her for breaking off my family. But I want to tell you, I'm not going to tell you the whole story because I'd probably end up doing this in a workshop tomorrow. But I'll tell you ultimately what happened. As I looked at my relationship with Pam, it was the same. It was the same thing as what my dad did to his family. I did to my own family. Okay, and there's a story around this which is really great, and I can describe it because it was profound to me. But what ultimately I saw was that I'd been blaming my dad all my life for all my failures. I didn't want to be responsible for it. I was still that five-year-old kid giving the problem to my brother, see? And I did that all my life. I didn't want to take responsibility for things. So I poured energy, as my life fell apart, into hating my dad and the circumstances of my life, which was connected to my dad, for all my mistakes. Well, who am I hating if I'm hating somebody for ruining my life? Somewhere in my mind, I knew I did these things. I made choices, and this is what was revealed. I made stupid choices and decisions, okay? And my life fell apart. They were based in selfishness, what I wanted, and they were dumb choices. That's all. And my life fell apart. But I didn't want to be responsible, so I poured energy into hating somebody else for my mistakes. Well, who are you hating? I was hating myself outside of myself. So what happens? I'm going to forgive myself by seeing him differently. And when I lifted the anger off of my dad, my hatred for myself about what I did to my own children left me. That's true. I have never had that hatred that I had, that depression. It lifted my depression. It lifted the... It's hard to describe this without telling the whole story, but that's what happened. I realized that it wasn't my dad, and I sat down and I wrote him a letter. And I thanked him for staying sober from the time I was 11, hoping I could walk in his shoes in recovery. I'm willing to pay any money I owe you. I'll do anything to straighten out my mess. And I let somebody read that before I sent it because I didn't trust myself. I didn't want any anger in it, see? But I had this shift, this transformation. Now, I had it in a few other areas. But you see, I got help from God in my thoughts as I wrote it and opened my mind in this way. I didn't believe in God when I did this. I did this without belief, okay? I did it with a commitment behind me that I'll do anything. And that's what happened. It resolved the conflict, and it's never come back. I didn't pardon my dad for all the terrible things he did. I saw that my story wasn't accurate. This is very different than pardoning. You pardon somebody, that means you're right. Okay? That's not what happened. It shifted. I was watching a video of a guy. I can't prove this. I'll just tell you what he reported. He said he learned Aramaic and studied the Aramaic Bible. This is just what he said. He said in Aramaic, the word forgive meant to change your mind. He said when they translated it to Greek, they didn't have a word for it, and it came out to pardon. And that's what was handed down to us. To pardon somebody for what they did and to change your mind about it is two different things. Now, I can't prove what he's saying about what he said, but I know the difference today, and I had that experience. So I sent that letter off, and I got this back from him. And I'm going to read this, and I'll shut up. This is dated February 25th, 1988. I sobered up September 4th, 1987. All this happened within my first 4 or 5 months of sobriety. And it altered me. I've never been the same since. He says, "Dear Rick, I got your very welcome letter today. Believe me, it was a very wonderful expression of your feelings and your desire and courage to change your life around. I know how difficult it is to turn 180 degrees, but I know you can do it. You are going about it in the right way. I am very proud of you." This is a man who never talked of his feelings and never talked of his alcoholism. He swept it under a rug. Don't do that if you got children. I'm telling you, he paid a major price with my older siblings, who one died drunk hating them and the other one still hates them. 20 years sober when he wrote this. "You know, Rick, we people in AA never get through making amends to people we have hurt. I have hurt you as well as my other kids. I can never complete making amends. There are some people I can never make amends to because they are gone. I can never make amends to my mother as I should have." That's sad. He's got regrets. 20 years. "I can never make amends to your mother as I should have." He was 6 years sober when she died. He never dealt with that. And now he's paying this price 20 years later. Continuous. "I just have to do the next best thing, and that is to work this AA program the best I can and constantly try to put into practice those 7 little words of step 12, practice these principles in all our affairs. Rick, you have made amends to me in a way you'll never realize. Just keep on doing things as you are now doing, and you will find a great life ahead of you." I do realize when you get well, you heal your parents. Really. No, I'm telling you, when you're sick and you're having trouble, problems, your parents feel responsible. And when you get well, you heal your parents. That's what it is. I know this from Al-Anon because people are coming in with adult children who are using, and they're blaming themselves all the time. And they always say the same things. If I just would have worked so much, if I wouldn't have been so harsh, if I wouldn't have punished them, if I wouldn't have beat them, on and on and on. I look at them, I say, look, if you think you can screw them up, then why don't you just fix them? Well, I mean, if you have that kind of power over people, you should be able to fix them, shouldn't you? "Just keep on doing things as you are now doing, and you'll find a great life ahead of you. Your mother loved all you kids very much, but you must remember that she was very sick from the booze and was not responsible for her insane behavior." She was sick. Nobody talked about this death. This is the first I heard of any of this. "But your mother was a very good mother. She nursed you kids through your sick spells many times, and she kept you clean and healthy." I was to an AA meeting last night. Interesting how this all coincided. And I heard someone say how they had feelings of guilt about someone they had failed to try to help, and it brought back memories of my own guilt feelings. I had promised Bill, that's my brother who died drunk, I was going to try to get some woman at the club to see her, meaning my mother, but I kept putting it off until it was too late. So I have had my share of guilt feelings. I have to use that serenity prayer a lot. Isn't that sad, the regrets he's got? "Rick, we are all responsible for our own behavior, but sometimes we are so sick we can't control ourselves and we become overwhelmed. But thanks to AA, we have tools to work with and people who support us. I want to thank you for your wonderful letter. You owe me nothing. I am very happy to hear how well you are doing. Your mother would be very happy for you. This is making amends too." It's a beautiful letter. And this is a good man.
but he's got a lot of regrets.
I'm enclosing a couple of cards for you and Pam to carry. It's a very special poem for me. I sometimes pass them out when I speak at meetings down here in Florida. I think the meaning is very good. That's the man in the glass card. You don't have to live up to other people's expectations. And I mean AA people's expectations. You got to be okay with yourself or you're miserable. It's going to be a nightmare. That's what that card says. It's beautiful. This will be all for now, Rick. Greet Pam for me and also Austin and Wyatt. Those are my two boys. Love to all of you and keep the faith, Dad. I didn't expect this. In fact, I wrote that first letter not to get this. I wrote the first letter to clean up my mess. You know why? Because I felt pretty crappy. I'd been treating him for 25 years as if he ruined my life. You know how you treat somebody who ruined your life. I hated him. I gossiped about him. I slammed him to anybody who'd listen. You know, really nice stuff like that. And when I saw what I had done and my story wasn't accurate, I just wanted to clean that up with him, and I wrote that first letter. My brother Bill died, must be about 15 years ago now, wanting a letter like this from my dad. He knew just enough of AA to use it as a weapon, you know? Really. Oh, he should make amends to me, that sort of thing, see? And he hated my dad. And I talked to him a week before, and he was just railing. Oh, he was just nuts on all these issues. And I tried to talk to him a little bit, but you can't talk to somebody who ain't interested in hearing it, okay? So I just gave up. I'd been to enough Al-Anon meetings, I gave up. And he was dead a week later. I mean, that's just the reality of this thing. Well, the difference between Bill dying and me being alive today is I took inventory and I wrote the first letter. That's the difference. And I cleaned up my mess, and I got a bonus. I got a benefit from it. And I had a relationship with him, and he moved back to Minneapolis last 10 years of his life. And I used to pick him up every Tuesday, and I'd take him over to the mission. I'd do a meeting at the Union Gospel Mission in St. Paul. And we drove back and forth, and we talked, and we had time together. I would have missed that relationship with him. Over what? A story I wouldn't challenge because I was right? Well, I found out I was wrong. You know, I wouldn't be afraid to do inventory. I'd be afraid not to do inventory because that's how this crap stays. When you expose it for what it really is, that's when the change happens. And that's what happened to me. And I've been excited and happy since. Not everything fixed up and everything's perfect, but I got to tell you something. I go through life at a different vibration than I ever have. So, you know, I thank God that I had enough... I did inventory because I was miserable, not because I wanted to work a program. I couldn't stand how I felt. So I just want to share something that comes out of a member's eye view of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll close with this. It says, "There must come a day, it seems to me, when every alcoholic, in or out of AA, finally sits down in the presence of his enemies." That's what you do with inventory. You sit down in your mind in the presence of the people you're pissed at. When he does, he will be amazed to discover that he is attending a meeting of one, himself. That's exactly what I saw. The day the alcoholic in AA realizes that his enemy is within, that the tigers are largely creatures of his own design and lurk in his own unconscious, he made them up. That is the day when, for him, AA becomes what I believe its founders meant it to be, a flight into reality. Wow. How much reality do I see today? I don't know. You know, it's gentle today. Things are different. Things are kind to me. It's just been an incredible journey for me, and it's really love. It's what we're talking about with love. Grizzly Adams taught me how to love. Remember Grizzly Adams? I used to get grounded a lot. I had to watch a lot of TV. Grizzly Adams taught me how to love. He was walking with the bear one day, and I remembered this, probably 14 years old when I saw this. He's walking with the bear in the field, you know, Ben is Buddy the Bear, and some guy comes up, he's a mountain man, if you don't know who Grizzly Adams was, so he's walking up in the mountains, and some guy comes up and he says, "Hey Grizzly," meaning the man, "why don't you tie the bear up? Aren't you afraid he'll run away?" He says, "If the bear don't want to be here, I don't want to keep him." What? Hey, if Pam don't want to be here, why would I want to keep her? selfishness. I want what I want. I don't care what she wants. Yeah, that's what it is. See, you end up angry. That's what it is. Selfishness. If the newcomer doesn't want to stay, let him go. Why get angry with him? You don't have to fire him. That's absurd. Why would you fire somebody? You know what? You know what I do with guys? I put inventory in front of them. They leave quick. They really do. If you know, I'm serious. You don't have to do anything else. If they're interested, you'll weed them out real quick. Who's interested and who isn't? I don't have them calling me at 2 a.m. with problems. You know why? Because I stopped solving their problems. I put inventory in front of them. They're going to solve their own problems. I'm not going to do it. What the heck? Running my life got me into AA. Why would you want me to run yours, you know? So thank you very much for that. The committee, Bob, you've been beautiful. Bob has just been a great, great host for me. And thank you for the opportunity to come here tonight. I really appreciate it.